The second case is People versus Mejia, and we can begin whenever counsel are ready.
Good afternoon. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Gregory Strauss. I appear today on behalf of the defendant appellate, Jose Mejia. I do appear through the public defender's office on a contract. This is one of their cases that they more or less farmed out. So I am representing through the public defender's office. I'll adhere to the court's admonition to not repeat the facts. This is not a fact-intensive case at all. In fact, I don't think there's anything factually disputed. And I'll try to avoid reviewing my arguments. To some extent, I need to, because I think they, in many places, are just so confusing. As I went back in preparation, I suffered that, I think we all feel that feeling where, whether it's a month or 2 years later, you look at this and you say, did I write this? And you wish you hadn't.
We have the same experience.
I could use a few clerks, though, for help. The first thing I think I need to jump to is the second argument and the question of whether this court wants to exercise jurisdiction over that. I think the Attorney General correctly raises that question and asserts that there was no preserved error here. And that is true. I think the reason that I really just skated completely over that was my discussion concerning structural error and a kind of assumption or reliance that if this is, and I'm saying it was, structural error, then preservation in the record below is irrelevant.
Mr. Strauss, you're just talking about the judicial notice issue, the 201 issue.
Yes, the second issue.
And when you said there's no preserved error, that's the issue you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
It came out a little broader than that.
No. I'm not
my
conceding.
My eyebrows went up through my forehead, I think.
It would be a very short discussion otherwise. If you look at structural error, and, you know, sometimes structural error wags the dog. It is not always automatically reversible. But I believe the last comment from the Colorado Supreme Court on this was in one of the more recent Dunlap cases. And it really said that it's rare circumstances when it's not reversed in Colorado. I incorrectly probably failed to note that that's what I was relying upon for the notion that this topic can be reviewed by this court if the court wishes to exercise its discretion on that. And it may be that simply finding that it is not automatically reversible structural error would allow you to say then we're not going to review it. The second thing I would point out is that as regards the court's review of this case is there are the doctrines that say the court may exercise its jurisdiction over matters that might suffer repetition but evade review. This unusual argument has certainly evaded review for 35 years that the federal rules of evidence in Rule 201 has been in force.
The evades review is usually a mootness issue. I'm not sure that it evades review as much as it doesn't get raised, perhaps because people don't think there's merit in it. No, and I don't mean that disrespectfully. And I guess let me ask you two related questions. Can you cite any case that says 201 is unconstitutional as applied, or even any rule of evidence for that matter? And can you cite us any case where it was held to be structural error?
No, neither.
Okay.
No. And in fact, Mr. Lee cites to a case I cited, which I believe was the Mintz case, which said that in the inverse, it was not structural error. I'll try and address that in just one sec, but no, there is a not just a dearth of authority, there is no authority here. This is, I think, as novel as a question can be on such what is otherwise a common and well-accepted rule. The other thing I would point out is, indeed, this is not a case of mootness, but the court can also review those matters that are of great public interest and importance. I think that this could very well be defined in that category, as it's a rule that affects, or could affect, many criminal cases, although it obviously does not and may not arise often. I don't think the frequency with which it arises in any way diminishes the possible importance.
Why should judicially noticed facts have any higher priority in the jury's mind than any other fact in the case?
I think that the difference here is that a jury is told, you must accept this fact. I have concluded that it is beyond reasonable people disagreeing about. And that carries a very, very different weight than simply evidence that comes through the stand or in documents. This has an imprimatur of the trial court judge, and I think that that puts it in a different category. How the jury deliberates on facts like that, obviously we can't know. But the risk is that there is improper evidence or emphasis, or an absence of proper emphasis. In other words,
how can this be anything but harmless? I mean, nobody argued this point. Nobody argued what that evidence even pertained to. It apparently pertained to the DNA sort of sloppy match. 10% of the world population produced this, and I can't eliminate the defendant from being in that 10%. Then you give the population of all these communities, and all you're saying is that if there are 70,000 people in Greeley, there are 7,000 people who could be the source of this. Is that correct?
That is.
Okay. That argument was never really made to the jury. This stipulation came in, or judicially found fact came in, but it was never tied to anything.
I think that's true. Closing argument is just that. It's closing argument, and the jury is free to consider all the facts. The defendant asked for this to come into evidence. So the fact that he might not have buttoned it up, I don't think is determinative on whether it's harmless or not. I think the court raises a good question, is why is this not harmless? I think to answer that question, we have to invade the province of the jury. We have to speculate what they did or did not emphasize, particularly with facts that, as I said, have come through the court, which is very different. So we're just going to put ourselves in the place of a jury here on what I see as a very fundamental rule of evidence that's important in a criminal case, and say, well, we would have seen the 9-to-1 ratio as good enough. The example I might use is, my speculation could be that they went back to the jury room, and one of the jurors sat there and said, I think 1 in 10 causes me concern that there could be 7,000 people in the county here who could have done this. This is a concern to me. Could be a relative that nobody has talked about or that she was protecting, something like that.
But what would someone else say, that there were only 40,000 and not 70,000?
Well, where I was headed with this was, another juror would say, well, wait a minute. And the guy says, well, I have a reasonable doubt about this, and I need to believe this because it's an accepted fact through Rule 201. But another juror turns to him and says, no, you can reject that, even though you have a reasonable doubt coming from the judge that says you must accept this fact, unless you don't want to.
What if the judge has said, I'm not going to take judicial notice of the population of Greeley or Weld County? Would that mandate a reversal?
No, that then merely becomes a failure to lay a proper foundation by counsel, which I'm not even sure I can imagine how a proper record would be made on that. It might come back to him on a 35C, but that's just failure on his part.
Let me ask you what I think is the bone crusher question.
Mine are yours.
Yeah, yours. Is identity an issue in this case?
Honestly, no.
Then why is this having anything to do with the case?
Well, for the same reason that Gideon v. Wainwright was structural error, that it is not a question of how would this have turned out. You know, you failed to tie it in. You never went on a theory of identity. This is going to the fundamental fairness of a trial. And
but if identity is not an issue, how can it be anything but harmless?
Well,
I mean, this is a young girl and her uncle, if I understand the relationship correctly. She knew who her uncle was. She knew who she was with. This was not a stranger.
No, the court is absolutely right in terms of the facts.
And he didn't say, I wasn't the one who was there.
No. He denied the events.
Yes.
He denied the events, most certainly and consistently. The fellow who sits through a trial when the trial court is saying, you don't get an attorney, does it matter whether he says this is an identity issue or whether he even preserves the issue by saying, I object, Your Honor, I don't have an attorney beside me?
Now you're talking about fundamental rights.
We're talking about errors that fundamentally affect the fairness of the judicial process.
Right, but that's a different issue.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, again, this is back to, is the tail wagging the dog here? Because you're reaching the conclusion first that this was harmless, and then saying, therefore, it can't be structural. And with the defendant sitting there saying, where's my counsel? On appellate review, I don't think the Attorney General could argue, well, wait a minute, the evidence was overwhelming here, so what difference did it make whether you had an attorney or not? That is simply not, to me, the question. The first question is whether taking a complete defense on one of the elements out of the jury's hands, totally, allowing them to find it as no reasonable doubt.
This is not a complete defense.
Pardon me?
This is not a theory of defense or a complete defense.
No. Nor did it go to an element, which you say throughout your brief.
Well, it could have. We don't know what was in the jury room as far as how the DNA evidence was interpreted by the jury. We're just speculating that, 90% was good enough. What if the judge had said, I'm finding, well, or the forensic analysis from the Colorado Bureau of Investigation said, well, I can eliminate 99.99999% of the population, and three people in this county could have done this. Or gone the other way, and the jurors said, well, and the judge said, I'm finding that this is the fact you must use, but you can ignore that. I'm finding a fact that disproves the case.
He never said this is a fact he must use. He just found it was a fact. I mean, he could have made the defense counsel could have said, I'd like the court to make a judicial finding of fact that at midnight in the mountain time zone, it's dark. Now, that may have nothing to do with the case. This happened inside the house with the lights on. There's no problem seeing. So the jury just ignores the fact that at midnight and mountain time zone is dark.
I agree. That's irrelevant.
So is this.
Well, this is why I tried to put in a very convoluted argument about possible remedy here. And that just turned into a mess. The reason I put that in, though, was to say, yes, there are facts that simply don't go to an element of the case. And, Your Honor, that's a great example. It has nothing to do with an element. It's simply put there for the sake of expediency and, you know, to move a trial along. And the remedy that I was trying to formulate was that it would be upon defense counsel to say, I want notice of this judicial fact, and I want the court to take notice that this does pertain to my disproof of an element.
What is the fundamental right that's being deprived? your view?
The fundamental right is the right to have a jury trial, the right to have due process.
The jury here.